So the meaning of these is that I have taken to recording the classes and then posting the recording online, which, you know, can be useful, I suppose. I don't think I'm the best speaker in the world. 3 hours of me droning on, like, Windows Media Player or something like that, I'm sure it's not the most pleasant thing in the world. You use it if you want. Otherwise, you don't. All right? Okay, so try this on. So, first thing, every class I'll put here the sheet. You come in and sign in. If you don't, then you're at the whim of whether I remembered you were here or not. Okay, so is there anybody who hasn't done this yet? Okay, and you are?
Sheldon.
Sheldon Rucker. Okay. Okay. So, no, we're not quite there yet. Okay. So, I don't know who here was not at Dan's last class, because I did a little introduction of myself there. You weren't there. Okay. So, just as a refresher, I am Jacob. My name is Juan Carlos Arevalo Baeza, which is very long, but everybody calls me Jacob. I work at Microsoft. So I bring the Xbox. I've actually worked in Microsoft Games for a few years and in the Xbox 360 platform team for a few years also. You know, I've worked in games like Fable, original one, the first one. They just released Fable 3. The original Forza. More recently, I've worked on games on Windows Phone and Facebook as part of our like multi-screen initiative. You know, we're trying to learn really how to do it well, making multiple games that talk to each other and all that. And in the platform team, I've done, for the most part, I've worked on the 3D implementation for Xbox 360. And I've also worked on high definition video codecs. I've worked on Xbox 360 backwards compatibility. And then a little bit on the Windows Phone. You know, I was part of the team that did the first graphics driver for it. So hopefully that means I have enough qualifications for this sort of thing. I'm originally from Spain. You know, I actually studied telecommunications engineering, if you ever heard of such a thing. It's not a common degree that you can get here in the States. But I've actually been making games for a very, very long time. My first published game was in 1986. As I was starting college, my brother and I finished the game. We actually got money for it. And it was sold in the stores and everything, which was very, very exciting. And, you know, I've been on and off on video games ever since. Hello? Signing sheet. Yeah, before you forget. And you are?
Robbie?
Okay. Yeah, I'll try to learn all your names, but typically I'm very bad at it. So I'm going to try to make it a point of asking people's names over and over again until they stick. You know, we're going to be together for 10 weeks, 2.5 months. So hopefully this is going to be exciting for you as it's going to be for me. This is my fourth time doing this course. Third time? My goodness. One of them. So that's as much as I was going to say about myself. If you guys have any questions, now is the time. Favorite color? No, nothing.
Any particular DirectX we should use?
Any particular DirectX? Yes, everything is in the course website. If anybody doesn't know where it is yet, then come to me, because then we have a problem, because I sent an email with the link to everybody this morning. Towards the bottom, you know, you have, actually I can pull it up if you want. Just there. Wow. There is a lot of clipping in this projector. I have to talk to somebody about that. Okay. So I'm not gonna maximize it. Instead, you can just look at it like this. Down here you have the links to everything. Previous years I've been posting slides in multiple formats. This year I just say get the PowerPoint viewer if you don't have PowerPoint. Okay. So we're gonna use Visual Studio 2010 and the June release of Direct3D, which is the latest one. Okay. And we're going to use Direct3D 9. I'm going to try to talk a little bit about all other things like OpenGL and Direct3D 10 and 11, but we're not going to be using them. You know, it's just going to be mostly so that you're aware of what the differences are and that sort of thing. The most used? Well, it depends. Yes? Okay, so you can be the judge whether Microsoft did the right thing or not. You know, there are opinions about it all over the place. When Microsoft released Windows Vista, we also released the first version of Direct3D 10, DirectX 10. And the implementation for that was only available on Windows Vista, not on Windows XP. And that is true to this date. D3D 10 and D3D 11 can only be used on Windows Vista or 7. They cannot be used in XP. Now, part of that might have been, you know, trying to push people to move on to Vista, because Directory 10 was so much better and so on, but things really didn't work that way, and lots of people still use XP. That computer over there is running XP. not mine, that one. And I'm sure at least one of you is still running XP probably in your laptop. There you go, 1, 2. I seriously recommend Windows 7, if you can. Of course, you know, as Microsofties have it easy because we get it cheap for ourselves, but it does cost some money to get the upgrade. Nowadays, more and more computers are actually moving to 7 because Vista was an operating system that people didn't like too much, at least a sizable minority of people, or sizable amount of people, or whatever you want to call it. Windows 7 doesn't have the same sort of problems that Windows Vista had, and it really works pretty well. So now, if you say, is D3D 9 used more than OpenGL? Now that's a question. I have absolutely no clue. I would say in Windows, D3D 9 is used the most. OpenGL is used in Linux, it's used in Macs, it's used in iPhones, it's used in Androids, it's used in those. Well, actually, yeah, I'm not sure what PlayStation and Wii do, but I believe they're kind of more OpenGL-ish than 3D-ish. So how do you count that? I don't know. In the world of Windows, yes, the 3D9 is pretty much the king. Were you going to ask one or no? Nope. It wasn't? Okay, no, that's fine. Go ahead. What I get out of teaching? Well, I get the kick of actually seeing people learn something. You know, for me, it is a bit of a rush, if you will. You will notice that as we do homework, you know, I will be following you quite closely. I return feedback to everybody about every homework, which takes some time, but hopefully you will appreciate it. Yes, I sent an email this morning. If you didn't get it, then either it went in where your spam goes, or we need to review your email address. Yep. So the email list is cp110a@theclasswebsitedomain. uw.thejacob.com. Hello. All right. Anybody else? Anything? You know all you want to know. Okay. I don't. So I'm going to go through each and every one of you and ask for your name, just so that at least I get it once. And then I'm going to ask you to tell me a little bit about yourself, your situation, why you're here, what you know about 3D graphics, about graphics in general, about video games, about computers even. So we start with you and we'll go.
My name is David. We're here because I really enjoy video games, so I want to learn how to make them. I've played a lot of video games over the years and kind of just grown up on a computer, so it's kind of something that I like to do.
When you think about making a video game, what do you see yourself doing? Because video games are done by a team of people.
Sure. I would like to start my own company and do a variety of different things with a group of people. So kind of designing out the video games, what they're going to be, like play-wise, and that kind of stuff. And then actually going through and programming them somewhere.
Okay, so some programming, some design.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. What about you?
Daniel.
Okay.
I also play
Well, I hope most of us here have played a video game or two in our time.
I've played with computers too my whole life, hardware, software. I'm pretty much my family's go-to IT person, so I just over the years developed the knack of associating with the computer, and I learned how to program. I took some courses in college, and I also took the C course with these two, or C++ with both of them. So, as for what I see myself doing with video games, I think one of the stranger parts for most people I've talked to is the development of the story and playability. Like, you can write the best story ever, someone can hand you the best story script ever, but if it doesn't play well, it doesn't really mean anything. So, kind of. The intertwined part of that interests me.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there are many kinds of video games, right?
Yeah.
Some have absolutely nothing but gameplay. Some have almost absolutely nothing but plot line or, you know, basically a story to them. And some are a little bit in between or not even, like, you know, racing game doesn't have a story really. But I don't know. There's lots of different kinds of video games. We're lucky here because we're talking about graphics, which means anything goes, right, as far as video games. When you start thinking about networking, for instance, which will be the one of the other two courses, I think the last one, then suddenly, you know, not all video games are good, you know, have much to do with the networking, right? Like story-driven games, they're very, very hard to network. It's also kind of hard to put AI on, for instance, you know, just because the AI has to, would have to be very interesting as the story, or else, you know, it kind of stands out, that sort of thing. So, I don't know, it's one of the reasons I like graphics, I suppose, you know, it touches a little bit of everything. You can do a Tetris that's very, very flashy, and, you know, it's basically nothing but that, right? And a very cool idea of gameplay underneath, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or cool. David?
Yes.
Daniel?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
My
sorry.
My name is James Day. I'm a programmer for Puget Sound Naval Shipyard. I like playing games, but I love programming, but I love solving difficult problems. The stuff I do at work is database. Read, update, delete stuff, which I don't find that interesting. I find doing this very interesting.
Okay. How good are you at math?
I'm pretty good at math.
Okay, cool. We're going to start with math today. So, you have met before.
Yeah, we have met before. I'm Alex, and I'm still working with Microsoft now in a different project.
Mm-hmm.
My previous project got done. So I'm still working on data access libraries, and this is the second time I take this course last year. Really, really good course, really interesting, and JCAP is one of the best, but a difficult course.
Mm-hmm.
I can assert that, so.
Yeah.
And don't leave the homework for the last day. Very valuable. And I'm interested in this course. I do play games, not as often as I wish for my wife likes me, but I'm really more interested in gaining more experience in different areas of software development. Graphics is a personal interest of mine. I'm not very good in math, but I keep working on improving that.
Cool. Maybe the grinding will do it.
Yeah, we'll keep just grinding.
We'll make perfect.
Until I understand it. So,
yeah.
Just a personal interest in me. And
mm-hmm.
I want to learn about graphics or networking, artificial intelligence, and apply not just to make games, but in data mining,
mm-hmm.
data presentation, and just to share that with
yeah.
data libraries, which is what I do pretty much all day long.
Yeah. There are all sorts of interesting ways to program.
Yeah.
Today, somebody, you know, you receive those emails, look at this YouTube video, look at whatever, you know, something on the net. And I got one of those today, and it was a video on YouTube about a robot that somebody made with Lego Mindstorms. You know about that? It's a little thing, you make your robot and then it has a brain and you can program that. You know, it's actually ARM 7, I mean, same CPU as today's smartphones. I mean, it can do pretty crazy things. What that thing did was take a Rubik's Cube, scan it, and then solve it.
Wow.
Physically. Which is amazing. You see that thing do it, and you're like, okay. Sure. Whoever did that had a lot of patience, you know, and then, of course, you go into the related videos, and there are other robots that do the same thing in different ways. There was one that solved a Sudoku. You actually write down a Sudoku, and it will scan it, figure out what numbers are there, figure out where the others should go, and then write them down with a pen.
Wow.
Which was even more impressive to my taste, but anyway. Yeah, yeah. But hey, you know, one nice thing about the LEGO Mindstorms, I've actually played with them a little bit, is that you have a few projects that you can just get from the web and do them. And they teach you a little bit about, you know, how far you can go, how far you can't, you know, how to do different things, different types of movements and so on, which is pretty cool. Of course, you know, it would take a long time. I mean, I would never finish one of those robots. I don't have enough time, not nearly with my day job and then this and other things. I mean, no. Huh?
Make a class?
Oh, make a class. So that my students do it for me? No.
I've heard of a nonprofit. What they do is they provide the set to teachers and teach the teachers how to use it so that the teacher can continue using other classes year after year and teach them basic physics and engineering.
That is pretty cool. Wow.
I saw that once during one of the giving campaigns or something.
Cool. Wow, okay, well, actually sounds interesting, you know, if you ever find it. Okay, next, sorry, what was it?
I'm Sheldon. Yeah, computers, I don't know, I've always had a computer, sort of. Like, I remember my first PC was an 8088. It was pretty fun. It had a turbo, it had shift and some F1 or something, and then it went from 4 megahertz to 8 megahertz. It was smoking fast.
Yeah, I know, I remember.
I work as a software engineer at Honeywell on their weather radar team. That's all right. Like you were saying, like, I really like solving more difficult problems. Don't get to do that as much at work, so I'm always looking for something else.
Cool.
And I love video games, so always have. And as far as video game aspects, I really like, I think I would really like AI.
Yeah, no, AI, good AI is, you know, can actually make or break a game just as much as graphics. I remember playing, you play Half-Life way back? I remember playing through it. At some point, you know, as you advance, you know, you start fighting the Marines, right, out there. And I remember just watching their behavior. It's like, I'm playing the game, right? And yeah, I kind of want to get through it, but sometimes I just throw a grenade where there are some just to see what they do, right? Or throw it one-sided to the other, and then there's a grenade, and then the scramble. I know that's just silly, you know, it just makes them feel real in some ways. Yeah, behavior, when AIs behave badly, it's exactly the opposite. Maybe the game is very flashy, but you're like, this is dumb.
The AI comes from, when I was in school, I made a board of controls for Double E, and so I'm all interested in both of them. I think that's sort of coupled with AI. Both and AI sort of intertwined.
Cool. Okay.
My name is Joe.
Joe.
I'm a designer at Bungie. I'm here because I don't know anything about graphics. I work with programmers every day, and I think that learning more about it will help me do my job better. I'm a designer, so primarily I work on the characters. I've been doing game design since 2003, and prior to that I studied animation in college, and I've worked as an animator as well, so I have a secret fantasy to hold positions in all three disciplines, like art, design, and programming.
Cool. Yeah, you might find it fun to know that, you know, for about a month and a half at the end of last year, I actually worked on 343 Industries, the team at Microsoft that ingested all that code from Bungie when you guys split. Of course, you know, they're working on games, and they just asked for help around NGS. Kind of nice to have a whole bunch of studios that you can poach people from time to time. So yeah, I actually work on the Halo code base for a little bit. It was interesting. It's humongous.
My name is Colin. I'm a production engineer at Bungie.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been into programming, so I wanted to see that aspect of games because I don't really get a lot of that at work.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to kind of maybe eventually move in that direction. So I thought this program as a whole would kind of lead me to that. I do like graphics as well, so.
Well, you better. Nah, you don't have to like them, but you have to get through them.
Right. I like math.
Yeah, okay, good. There's a lot of math in graphics, especially when you want interesting graphics.
My name is Jesse. I also work at Microsoft. I work in the G-Dragon group at Live Labs. And so there, we do a lot of 3D imaging technology stuff. So obviously I ran into a lot of people that were very, academic, math-oriented, graphics-oriented. And that really got me interested in it, just like the concept of what we're talking about. I used to know that. Not anymore, but obviously for lack of being used. So that got me really interested in this graphics course. And so I am also a gamer, but I think for me, this course is more just about learning something new and different and trying to rediscover what I once maybe hopefully knew.
Cool. Yeah, so image analysis and that sort of thing, which is precisely the opposite that we're going to do here, which is synthesis of images. Actually, sometimes when you want to do analysis, what you need to do is synthesize what you think it's going to be and then compare and then rinse and repeat. I've seen that a few times, which is kind of interesting too. You know, like I remember seeing one implementation of the skeletal pipeline of Kinect, the thing that analyzes the image from the camera and figures out where your body is, you know, what you're doing. And they're actually rendering. They had a software renderer in there, 3D render. So they would say, hey, you know, this is where your skeleton is, and then, you know, render stuff. I mean, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
I'm Ben. I used to be a trustee.
I play board games a lot. I played through the Halo series and Age of Empire series. And I'd like to get into the casual game business, I think, and converting board games onto the computer.
Yeah.
So I'm taking this course and figuring out how it's done.
Okay, board games. Never actually talked anything about board games or that sort of thing here.
Well, Settlers of Time on the Xbox.
Yeah, and Carcassonne. Carcassonne is my favorite. I had never heard of it, and when it came out on Xbox, I'm like, what the heck is this?
It's fairly popular.
Yeah, I got hooked.
I'm Frank. I work in pro audio, a company called Rain. They're known mostly for DJ products. I work on contractor install products. So these are like DSP boxes that get installed in hotels and restaurants, stadiums. They hook up to control systems that let you adjust the audio depending on how the environment changes. So say you're in a conference hall and they reconfigure the rooms, you know, it'll change the effects on the speakers. So it sounds the way you want it to sound.
Acoustics, yeah.
And there's other cool peripherals to do, like echo canceling and things for microphones and stuff like that. So those all integrate into the system. I went through the C++ course here, mostly so I could do that job. It was C++ server-side programming, embedded server. And then I thought, well, you know, I want to keep going with this, because once the server part wrapped up. We started doing more C# programming on the client side, but I didn't want to forget all the C++ stuff I learned, so that's mostly why I took this class. I'm not a gamer at all. I think the last time I seriously played games was like the Atari 2600
okay.
days. But they interest me. I bought Black Ops and started playing that. And I guess those are the kind of games that interest me the most, or the immersive ones.
Immersive, hyper-realistic graphics, and mayhem all over the place, maybe.
Yeah, I watched a guy lived in my house for a week, and I watched him play Grand Theft Auto San Andreas for a whole week.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was kind of an adventure. I never got that wrapped up in it myself, but I could see how people could get
it. Yeah. Cool.
You should see some of the World of Warcraft people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My brother got me into that one. I lasted 2 months before I canceled. It was taking too much time, and I don't know. For some reason, it is not my kind of game anyway. World of Warcraft, but it was interesting.
Okay, I'm Robbie.
Robbie.
My main interest to learn graphics architecture itself, and then the computer graphics, because I work a lot in the medical imaging devices where the 3D is becoming a de facto mode for real time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to learn these two and see how these two can be adapted to the medical imaging.
Mm-hmm.
So I work at the university as an affiliate faculty and also as a research scientist with Hitachi Medical.
With?
Hitachi.
Oh, okay.
Medical.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
My name is Steve. I'm a Java developer currently, and games and building. I think what I do now isn't really that exciting. I think ideally I'd like to maybe just to work a good career, because I'd like to work on something that somebody's actually interested in using, rather than, you know, the stuff I work on now is, you know, an end to a means rather than a means to an end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool.
My name is John. I'm a contact lawyer at Google. I play video games my whole life, but I've always been trying to do like the monster that's with the whole design industry. Taking this class because a regular degree doesn't really prepare you to get a job in the industry. It's kind of in depth knowledge that we're doing.
Yeah, the video game industry has been changing, and it is slowing down now, finally, somewhat. But yeah, I mean, see where I started? I started making games because I couldn't think of anything else to make, and I had to make something with a computer. Actually, my first program I got any money for was a simulator for blackjack. An uncle of mine was really into the game and decided to publish a book. So he's crazy. He's a genius, okay? He worked out all the formulas for blackjack, every single last one of them, made all the calculations, and made a whole bunch of tables that say, if you're in this situation, do this. If you're in that situation, do that. And your probability of winning is, and he actually calculated that. Okay, and then he hired my brother and I to make a little program. That's how I got my first computer. I was kind of learning, but it was hard without a computer, you know, from the book. You know, it was interesting, but could only get so far. So I guess I was lucky that he was willing to put up money for a computer. And yeah, we made the program. It run games of blackjack, like hundreds of thousands of them, and collected the results. No formulas, no calculations, right? Independent verification, and he was right. To this date, I do not understand, because probability theory is one of the hardest things that I've ever come across in my life. Okay, it's a mind bender. You know, nothing is the way you expect it to be. I don't know. Maybe some of you are better at it than I will ever be. Okay. But anyway, it was kind of interesting. But that computer, okay, had 64K of RAM. You know, it was a 4 megahertz Z80 microprocessor. You know, 8 bits. It's just ridiculous. And we've come a long way. We've come a long way, and now we do 3D graphics. I actually went through a stage where we did 3D graphics in software, right? Which was also very interesting, as you will see. And I'll leave it at that. Okay. So I guess we should begin. I actually have to apologize. I think I'm coming down with something. Maybe so my voice is not up to snuff right now. Hopefully it'll be better next week. We're going to start talking a little bit about math. And math in, let's see, here. Sorry. I don't even know what I'm doing. Ah. Okay. Ha! Works. So we're going to be doing quite a bit of math this next 10 weeks. So I thought we would start with that. When we think about 3D graphics, most math is vector math, matrices and vectors and other things. And we'll see them especially in calculating positions in space. When you have a 3D mesh, it's made of triangles. Those triangles have vertices around them, and those vertices have locations in space, right? And we need to manipulate those locations. You know, like we might want to spin a spaceship, you know, or do things like that, okay? That's one place where we do math. It gets complicated when instead of a spaceship that's spinning, it's a character that's dancing, right? Or something such. We will also be using math in calculating with colors and with light intensities and with other quantities like those. The idea here is once we have the surface of a 3D mesh, we want it to look as beautiful as possible, right? And that involves on every pixel quite a bit of calculation. And again, there are simple formulas that we can use there that work most of the time. And then if we want to do something like Call of Duty or one of those hyper-realistic games or Halo, we have to use somewhat more complex formulas and methods. In the end, you know, whatever we see is always light, right? I look at the wall and it's white, but that's just light that bounces off the wall, right? Everything that we see is light. So if we were to do the perfect 3D render, it would just be a light calculator. Just that. The only thing that's special about a surface that you see, like that wall, is that light bounces off of it, ultimately. But of course, you know, we're not always going to do the perfect light calculations because that would take us up a computer, probably a quantum one. So we're going to fake. Everything is fake. It's just different degrees of fake. Sometimes you do things one way because, you know, that's the way things, you know, work better in a specific game. Think, for instance, a game that's rendered like a cartoon, right? That doesn't need to actually do a lot of light calculations. It needs to do a little bit, though. It needs to fake something that feels okay to our eyes. And our eyes are used to seeing the world, right? So even cartoons have highlights that move depending on, you know, which way the cartoon character is looking, for instance. There are even strange things when you think about cartoons. There is actually a game that's coming out or came out recently about Mickey Mouse for the Wii, I think. So apparently that game was kind of interesting to make because Mickey Mouse had never really been portrayed in a video game, you know, where there is full freedom. Imagine you're Mickey Mouse and you turn around, right? So which way do the ears point and where are they, right? Even that is an interesting little bit of math that they had to do there. And more than math is probably more like an algorithm, right? Or a decision machine. Because if you see Mickey Mouse in cartoons out there, you know, the ears are always on both sides of the head, no matter which way Mickey Mouse is pointing, right? So Mickey Mouse is looking that way, those are the ears. Looking ahead, those are the ears. Looking that way, those are the ears, right? So they kind of move in the head depending on where he's looking, right? And you know, that's an interesting little problem that you probably don't think about off the top of your head, okay? So the other end of the spectrum is when you want to do super hyper realistic stuff that is gritty and dirty and you can see it, that is gritty and dirty and it's shiny and it's all sorts of it has all sorts of qualities that we need to account for in the formulas. And in the end, what we have is the way the light is supposed to work and then the model, the mathematical model that we apply to our 3D graphics and how well it maps to the reality, right? We need to know what are the weaknesses, you know, what does it not do? All that sort of thing. Make sense? So what kinds of operations are we going to do in math? Is this thing not working at all? I pressed it. Okay. So when we think about 3D graphics, you know, the main thing that we use is vectors. They represent things, okay? And that's something that you always need to have in mind when you are programming. You know, what does this vector represent? Sometimes they represent points, locations in space. Sometimes they represent directions, that way or that way. Sometimes they represent colors. You'll often be using, well, or at least sometimes you'll be using, you know, just regular vectors to represent colors, in which case, you know, you have like the four coordinates three coordinates of a three-dimensional vector, which are x, y, and z, and they'll just correspond to the three components of a color, which are red, green, and blue, usually in that order. But you have to keep it in mind somehow, right? You have to know what that vector is representing. And for vectors, we have a bunch of operations. I don't expect you to have much problem with those. You know, we multiply them with a scalar, with a number. We can multiply two vectors with each other in two different ways. There's the dot product and the cross product. The cross product is the weird one because the order of the factors actually does matter in that case. And it returns another vector. You know, the dot product returns just a number. I expect that you're all more or less, at least a little bit familiar with these operations. One interesting thing about the cross product is that what it does is it takes two vectors that represent directions and returns another vector which is orthogonal to the two. It's perpendicular to both of them. There are only two directions in which that can be, this way or that way. If you're taking the cross product of these two, you end up having something like this or like this, okay, depending on the order. But that's in three dimensions. We also need to operate in two dimensions. So how would you do a cross product in two dimensions? Anybody have an idea?
The third dimension is always
constant. That's one way. You just invent a third dimension and, you know, give the same, you know, like put a zero in it for both vectors and then do the cross product in 3D. But what you get back is a three-dimensional vector, not a two-dimensional vector. So it's not the same thing in some ways.
You have a 2D plane,
that's
any cross product is either
going to
be plus something z or minus something z.
Yeah. So, well, the thing is, there is no cross product in two dimensions. It just isn't. You know, it's only defined for three dimensions, and then I think it was defined for seven. Not for six or five or four. You know, it's one of those strange things. And when you start looking at math, it, you know, you see those types of things all over the place.
Is it used in string theory?
I don't know. You got me there. string theory. Yeah, I don't know how many, or 20 and a half. So the thing is, that question was, you know, a tricky question to ask. How do you do a cross product in two dimensions? That's not the right kind of question. It never is. The first thing is, okay, so you want to do a cross product in two dimensions. First, why do you want to do a cross product? And then, is there any other way? And one reason why you do cross products in three dimensions is to find a vector that is perpendicular to two others. You have two vectors that make up a plane, for instance, two edges of a triangle. You do a cross product to find the vector that is perpendicular to the triangle. That's one way. That's one reason to do it. So the thing is, in two dimensions, when you think about perpendicular vectors, you know, when you have one vector, then you already just have, you know, two possible directions that are perpendicular to it. You don't need a second one. So in two dimensions, how would you find a vector that is perpendicular to another? Does anybody know? Dot product? No. Dot product gives you a number. What do you do with it? Yeah. So think about it this way, okay? We have a vector that goes from here to here, okay? This vector has coordinates x and y, okay? When and this vector represents basically an orientation, a direction, this way, right? If you want to find the perpendicular one, is either that way or that way, right? Hmm?
Invert one of the signs.
You invert one of the signs, but not just invert one of the signs. I mean, imagine you have this one. Okay. If you invert the y, you get this, which is not perpendicular. You have to invert and swap them. That's all. That's what it takes, really. Okay. So this one here will be. Y and minus x. Mm-hmm. So just doing that one vector is kind of like the cross product is in 3D. Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, you know, just be aware that some operations are available in some vectors or quantities or entities, right? And some other operations might not be. Okay. And if you ever find yourself wanting to do something that doesn't exist, then the best thing you can do is think back. So, okay, so why do I want to do that? And then, okay, so is there any other way? Is there anything else that I need? Right? And, you know, this is one example of that. Another type of quantity that we're using is matrices. And matrices are a little bit like vectors. We can multiply them by a scalar, you know, a number, and they have multiplication and so on. The matrix product is a little bit like the cross product in that matrices, you know, you can't just invert them. You know, what you get is a different thing. And then they have other operations that you can look in literature. I'm not going to explain every single last one of them, not by far. Okay. A little special is the transposing one. You know, you typically will use it once we get into using shaders, just because there's a disconnect between the way matrices are represented in the C++ code and the way they're represented in the shader code. They need to be transposed in between the two. There is a reason for that, but you know, suffice it to say that you know it'll come up there. You know, transposing is just switching the elements across the diagonal. Matrices and vectors can be multiplied with each other. By far the most common that we're going to do is 4x4 matrices multiplied by 4x4, by 4-dimensional vectors. And the reason to use 4-dimensional vectors is that, well, there is a mathematical trick to doing 3D and perspective. You do it for translation. I mean, the first time I ever did a 3D engine, I never knew about 4x4 matrices. You know, I represented transformations as a 3x3 matrix and a three-dimensional translation, which is like a 4x4 matrix with one column removed. That column is removed because in everything except for when it goes into doing three-dimensional perspective calculations, that column is always 0001. Okay, so so it is not quite as necessary to use 4x4 to do all the 3D calculations, but in order to project them on the screen, to put everything on screen, you know, the trick is actually very, very useful. And the fact that we can just have a 4x4 matrix and have everything, including translation in it, is kind of neat. So there's a convention issue here between D3D and OpenGL. You know, in all the literature that uses OpenGL, okay, you will see matrix multiplied by vector. In all the literature that deals with Direct3D, you will see vector multiplied by matrix. The reason is that you can multiply a vector to a matrix on the left if that vector is written horizontally as a row, right? And you can multiply it on the right if it's vertical. So this would be something like that. Okay. And the end result here will be vertical, and the end result here will be horizontal. You know, just. The operations that you do when you do that are the same. You know, these two matrices here are actually not the same matrix. This would be transpose of this one. And again, it's just a convention. You know, the actual multiplications that are done are the same. Multiplications and additions and all the operations. It's just a different way of writing. And you will have to adjust if you read OpenGL literature and then try to implement that in Direct3D. Just as a word of caution. The reason this is like this is because vectors, when written like this or like that, you know, they can be considered as a matrix, which is not square, right? And so this is just general multiplication of matrices. So let's look at a few transformations that we can do of these vectors. Transformations that can all be represented as matrices. Okay. I'm drawing them here in two dimensions, okay, that it's much easier to visualize things in two dimensions than in three. And all matrix algebra works perfectly in two dimensions. Okay, wherever you would normally use a 4x4 matrix, now you can use a 3x3. Whenever you would use a four-dimensional vector with a one at the end, now you can use a three-dimensional vector with a one at the end. So there are only two coordinates. Okay. Translation is very easy. Doesn't really need to say anything further about it. Okay, we all understand that. You have two vectors and you add them together, and these basically adds the components, the x component with the x component, the y component with the y component. And this is the translation applied to get these two points up there. Rotation is a little bit more involved. Okay. This is the formula for two-dimensional rotation. This is a 2x2 matrix multiplied by this vector. And what it does is it rotates. If these are the coordinates of this point here, the result is the coordinates of this point, which is basically rotated around the origin. Okay? Rotation, when done like this, is always around the origin. The formula that you see here is just for 2D, okay, for two-dimensional rotations. The formula for three-dimensional rotations is a lot more complicated, because instead of one angle, it has three. Because a three-dimensional rotation is a three-dimensional thing. Roll, pitch, and yaw, for instance, three angles, okay? I don't put the formula here. You can read it up in literature, or you can just call the function that you give it at the angles and gives you the matrix. Okay, it's good to know what it means, though. Scaling, making something bigger or stretching it in one direction more than another one, is done by a matrix kind of like this. And again, in three dimensions, it's the same, more zeros up and down, three dimensions to scale. Okay? And it's just a multiplication, like same thing as rotation. Share is a very strange operation, you know, specifically non-uniform stretch in some ways, although the actual size of the box in here will never change. Always keep the same area. Same thing in 3D, when you share, you always end up with the same volumes, for instance. And it has this very strange expression. Shares, the main reason for you to know about them is to avoid them like the plague. Okay? Whenever you see that a matrix doesn't look like kind of like this or like, you know, those, you know, those rows and those columns are all normalized. If you take the magnitude of those vectors, you know, vertical or horizontal, you always get one. That's the main way to spot a rotation. This one is just, you know, it's just the diagonal. And this one is, you know, lopsided. That's bad. Okay? So just be careful with that then. So we have translations and rotations and scales and shares, and my goodness, just can't see. I don't like this. I kind of want to start fixing it, but no, it doesn't go any less. Position. Okay. Okay. No, that's the keystone. That's not it. That's definitely not it. I probably shouldn't be doing this here, but. Shift. Okay. That'll probably be good enough. Can see a little. So we know what we're talking about. So basically any possible transformation that you could possibly ever think of, any that is linear, okay? And linear is a strange kind of property, you know, it's a good one. It's a combination of those, okay? And typically you can represent them as this, you know, a point that gets multiplied to some scale matrix and some shear matrix and some rotation matrix. And then plus some translation, okay? So usually these all combined, so you end up with this. This is what I did in my first 3D engine that I did, okay? This is the concept of the transformation. It's a combination of rotation, scale, and share, and then a translation added at the end. Okay. And that's how you can write it. I mean, it's just a matrix with four components and then a translation, which is two more in 2D. And 3D would be a 3x3 matrix and a three-dimensional vector there. So the idea of adding another dimension, which in 3D would make this a 4x4 matrix, is to combine the two. And you can do it like this. I mean, the way matrices are multiplied is this column multiplied by this row, dot product. That makes the first component. This column multiplied by this row, that makes the second component. So you can see that putting a 1 here, you know, 1 just multiplying this, and then the dot product adds those products together, we end up giving us the same thing as this here. I don't know if you see it, Hopefully you do. No? Yes? No? Okay. That's the last step. This vector here looks different than this one. You know, we can make them the same by adding this column here. You know, when I take the dot product of this with this, I get a 1, always, guaranteed. Because Px is multiplied by 0, so that's 0. And Py is multiplied by this 0, so that's 0. And then 1 multiplied by 1 is 1. Add them all together, and 0 plus 0 plus 1 is 1. That one. Over there. Okay? In OpenGL, this would be a transpose matrix. So translation would be here. Okay? And the zeros would be here. That is actually kind of neat. That is actually kind of neat because then, you know, if you represent this matrix in the most natural manner, okay, the last row is all 0, 0, 1, right? So you could just not store it when you store matrices, you know. And that's the reason why the transpose is used in shaders, you know, because of efficiency of packing.
The ordering which we apply the transform.
Well, it matters in the final result. Yes. But the thing is, you know, you can represent any transformation, you know, with a combination of those.
Okay.
Whoa.
So yes, matrix multiplication is not
commutative. Yeah, matrix multiplication is not commutative, so the order of those matters for the final result. But you can represent any possible. In order to represent any possible transformation that you could make up, you know, you might need to put like another share here, or you know, mix several of those. Just. Yeah. In general shares, you want to avoid them. Okay. So, scaling and rotation, you know, have the neat property that they can be multiplied in any order and you get the same. Well, actually, no. Only if the scale is uniform, if all the values are the same. This stuff is tricky. Even I forget sometimes the finer details on the spur of the moment. So doing algebra with all of these, with vectors and matrices, is, well, it's quite important to do right. And for the most part, it works just like the algebra that you learned in high school. With any luck, you remember, or you've been doing algebra after high school or after college. Those things are easy to forget, and like a bicycle, they tend to be, you know, easy to pick up again. So algebra is having an equation like this and figuring out what this x must be. So in normal when we're dealing with numbers, you know, you would do it like this. You would say, oh, this subtract c on both sides, that's b minus c here, and then divide by ab on both sides, and you end up with the lone x over there, and this on the right side. Okay? Anybody have any doubts about that? Forgotten? Okay. With matrices, it is done exactly the same way, except for one thing. There is no division. Okay? There's multiplication by the inverse. And also except for the fact that the multiplication order matters. Okay. So in this case, you would do, yes, minus c, that's fine, you know, same thing as above. No problem. When you go to say, oh, divide by AB on both sides, what you have to do is multiply by inverses in order to cancel these A and these B. Okay, in order to do that, you need to multiply first the inverse of A so that these two cancel. and then the inverse of B, so that these two cancel. When you multiply matrix with its inverse, you get the identity matrix, which is like a 1. You know, you don't want to multiply it because it doesn't do anything. So they have to be multiplied on the left side in that order here, and also on the right side. So you end up with D minus C, and then this thing's multiplied on the left in that order, which is important. Okay. So it's just a matter of being careful and knowing what you're dealing with. It's matrices. Okay? Some matrices do not have inverse, in which case the thing that you want to find the solution for doesn't have a solution. It does not exist. That is true. There's a property of matrices which is the determinant, which is a combination of the elements of the matrix. If that determinant is zero, then the matrix cannot be inverted. It's kind of like the zero with numbers. You cannot invert the zero.
Is that why you should avoid shears?
No. Shears can be perfectly inverted. The main thing with shears is that it's a very misbehaving type of transformation, you know. My goodness, I've forgotten. I think I had a slide with I described some of those things. But basically, the different types of transformations have certain properties in what they keep about the original thing that you are applying the transformation to. Just imagine a square, right? Imagine a square. When you rotate that square, what do you get? Another square. It is rotated, but it's still a square. You know, four equal sides, four 90-degree angles in between them. Okay? And rotating the square means taking this point and this point and this point and this point and applying exactly the same transformation, the same rotation transformation to all of them. Okay? That's what we mean by rotating the square. So rotation is very well behaved. You know, it preserves the shape of whatever it transforms. Okay? Rotate this like this, still a mouse. Okay? Scale also preserves things, okay? It does not preserve distances, because when you blow something bigger, distances grow also larger. But it preserves all the angles. If you apply a scale to these actually, no, that's not true. Does not preserve all the angles, depends on the direction. So uniform scale preserves all angles. It also preserves the proportions within. Preserves the shape, just different size, right? Non-uniform scale, I see it used sometimes, not very much in computer graphics, just because it distorts. Shear, it doesn't preserve absolutely anything except the volume or the area of the thing that you are transforming. Which is not a very useful property when you are dealing with graphics. Nobody's found much use for that. Non-uniform scale is transforming this into this. Like, squeeze this way, stretch that way, or stretch both ways, but twice as much in this direction. Yeah. Uniform scale would be, you know, always stretch by the same amount in all dimensions, or squish by the same amount in all dimensions. Yeah. Okay. It distorts. Think about it this way. Okay. And this is a little, you know, few classes ahead, but what the heck. Just imagine that you have a square like this, okay? These faces, these sides of the square have normals, right? Just imagine if you share this, you know, what happens to the normals? You know, it's kind of weird, right? You share like that, and, you know, like this normals end up being the same, but this one's very, very different. Okay. This complicates math. Okay, that's basically what it does. Now, I'm not saying that you will never ever find a good use for shares. I'm telling you that from experience, okay, they're more of a hassle than they're worth it. When it comes to computer graphics. Just because they do weird things like those. And the thing is, in the end, if you're doing skinning, okay, you end up finding those things no matter what. Okay, but at that point, there is absolutely no choice. You want to do the skinning. You know, with the shares, I don't know. I mean, you can use them. I'm not saying you can't, but typically, you will use, like, uniform scales, maybe, and rotations for the matrix part of the transform. So reference frames are also a very important mathematical concept, okay? So look at the tip of this pen. What are the coordinates? You know, this tip has a position in space. What are the coordinates of that tip? Not just that. Depends where the axes go, okay? Basically, it depends on which frame of reference, okay? A frame of reference is a place to put, to refer coordinates to, okay? Imagine that we say the position 000 is over there, right? You know, in that corner on the floor, okay? And then the x coordinates are the distance along this direction. Okay, that's the x coordinates. Say in meters. Okay, because I'm European. And the y, say it's vertical. You know, it's going up, also in meters. Okay, and say that the z coordinates are that way, in that direction, also in meters. Okay, all from that point of reference over there. So now, what are the coordinates of this pen here, of the tip of the pen? Now we can express those coordinates, okay? We can say the x is, I don't know, 8 meters, maybe 10, something like that. And the y is 1.5 to here. And the z is, I don't know, 1.5 also, okay? So there you go. Now we can give it coordinates, okay? There can be many, many different frames of reference, okay? That is one. I just pulled it out of my hand. Another one could be, oh, that's the 000 over there, and the x goes up, and the y goes that way, and the z goes that way, or that way, and all the coordinates are negative. Or, you know, the vectors, you know, the different coordinates could go in any direction. You know, the x goes that way, and the y that way, and the z goes that way. Okay? And you can express any point in any frame of reference. It'll just be different coordinates. Okay? And as we deal with graphics, we will have to deal with multiple frames of reference. Mm-hmm.
Do we ever deal with non-orthogonal
frameworks? Yeah. There's one place in the pipeline where you have to. And once you get into the finer points of advanced graphics, then you start seeing also non-orthogonal frames of reference that you just forget that they're not orthogonal, and you know, hope that everything works more or less okay, things like that. Yes. You know, there's things like if you guys know what bump mapping is, you know, it's applying a sort of lighting effect on a surface to make it look like it has bumps in it. You know, that's not perfectly smooth. If you apply that to something that is skinned, right? you know, you end up having to deal with local frames of reference at every point in the surface. And those frames of reference are kind of not always perfectly orthogonal. But typically you ignore that. You know, things like that, yeah. Okay? So you define that by as many vectors as there are dimensions, you know, the X, Y, and Z. You need vectors, right? And then the origin, you know, where 0, 0, 0 is. You know, that's how you define them. Or at least that's how they are conceptually defined. And all vectors are always expressed in some reference frame. So when you're dealing with vector math, okay, it's a good idea to know what frame of reference any particular vector refers to. Or if you have matrices, you know, what those matrices do with those frames of reference. Okay. And that's mostly a mental exercise. Sometimes you put it in comments in the code, you know, so that you don't forget. And you never mix inappropriately vectors that are expressed in different frames of reference. You know, the same thing as you can't mix miles and kilometers, because if you do, you know, your space probe will just crash in the desert, which it did. So these two here is one way to visualize a reference frame. It's just two vectors, which are the unit vectors. This point in this reference frame will be 1, 0. And this point will be 0, 1, right? In this other frame of reference, this vector will be 1, 0 in this frame of reference. And this point here will be 0, 1. But in this frame of reference here, this point is 2, 2, according to this grid. Okay? So again, we have one point here, and it has two different sets of coordinates depending on the frame of reference that we express it in. So these are the coordinates of this point P, expressed in this frame of reference, the one without the primes, okay, is 3 and 2. 3 and 2. The origin of this frame of reference here is 1 and 3. And these two vectors also have 1 minus 1 for this one, and 1 and 1 for this one, okay, in this frame of reference, okay? You can do exactly the opposite, and express this point P in this frame of reference, okay? That's where it goes, like P X prime, because it's referred to this coordinate. And in that frame of reference, this vector is 1.5 and 0.5, which we can't see because of this stretch of the projector. and so on and so forth. You know, we can express this point and these two vectors in these reference frame. Okay? This is just one way to visualize it, okay, and to actually get some numbers so that they can grab a hold of the concepts here. Now, the trick is how to express this point in one reference frame if all we have is its coordinates in a different reference frame. That allows us to transform the coordinates of this point from one reference frame to another. Still the same point, it's just two different reference frames. Am I losing anybody? Okay. So this is basically a way to express this point's x-coordinate in this frame of reference. Okay, it's the difference between these two points here, from here to here, and then you take the dot product with this vector here. Now, dot product is a very fun little operation, okay? When you take any vector, where did I put it? That's right here now. When you take any vector, and find the dot product of that vector with some other vector, which is unit length, okay, which is unit length on some frame of reference, what you find is this distance, okay, and this is 90 degrees, so this is perpendicular. So you take the unit vector, you extend it, and project the vector on the direction of the unit vector, okay, and you get this distance. When you take the dot product of two vectors, but the second one is not a unit vector, then it is basically the same thing, but multiplied by the direction, by the magnitude of this u vector, okay? Make sense? I see blank stares a little bit. So if you express, if you want to express this coordinate of this point, it's x coordinate in this frame of reference, okay, you can just do it like this. The nice thing about a formula like this is that it's general, okay? It doesn't matter which frame of reference you express any of those on, okay? It does not matter. If I want to express the x coordinate of this point in this frame of reference, I just take the same thing, you know, this point, wherever it is, minus this one, and then dot product with this, and that gives you the x coordinate for that vector. And you just have to divide by, you know, the square of the magnitude of that, unit vector over here. If it really is a unit vector in whichever frame of reference it's expressed on, this is a 1. Okay? If not, it adjusts the length for that. Okay? And same thing with the y. Right? It's just a different axis. So, the idea here is that you can express any point, any arbitrary point that you have in one frame of reference, okay, you can find the coordinates in a different frame of reference as long as you just do this to it. Those operations here, you know, they just get transformed like this into a matrix. Okay. And that is just a regular linear matrix like we saw before with this column with 0, 0, 1. Okay. So what this comes to say is transforming the coordinates of one point from one frame of reference to a different frame of reference is just a matter of multiplying the correct matrix, the matrix that transforms between frames of reference. Okay? And what this is just the way to calculate it.
So when you're going from local to world space, this one?
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see about the applications of frames of reference next week, or this week if we have time, but I don't know about that. Other years I've gone through this a little quicker. You know, I decided to pace myself a little bit this time. But yes, so as we render, as our 3D models go through the graphics pipeline, they actually go from frame of reference to frame of reference. Usually have, like, you know, their own local frame of reference, you know, where the geometry has been defined on, you know, you get numbers and those are referring to the frame of reference. Then you have the world frame of reference, you know, which is, oh, you know, so this is my origin right here, right? Or Washington, D.C. or whatever, you know. You define a frame of reference for the world and then, you know, you have transformations that place any object anywhere in that world. And then you have the camera frame of reference, which is I'm looking at the world from here. So I want the world to be transformed into something that's referring to me because I am the one looking out. So any camera will always have some position, direction. I mean, you've dealt with cameras in the first quarter. And that, you know, the camera matrix, the view matrix that you had to give Direct3D, that was just a matrix that performs a change of frame of reference from world to local, you know, camera local. And then there are more. I mean, they get a little more internal. There is the projection matrix that transforms into a homogeneous space that's easier to deal with, you know, to do the perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, we did talk about that, but mainly after we got the concept, we just let the black box.
Yeah, I know.
The camera is here pointing this way.
This is advanced graphics, though, so, you know, I'm kind of pushing through a little bit and trying to get you to understand what is going on there. Yeah.
In computer graphics, we use mainly cartesian points, or we can see.
Yes.
Spherical coordinates and polar coordinates.
Yeah, polar coordinates, I have hardly ever seen any such thing. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty much, yeah, Cartesian, regular, you know, XYZ type coordinates. But yeah, I mean, you could think up frames of reference that have nothing to do with, you know, with Cartesian coordinates, like polar coordinates. And in that case, you can't just multiply a matrix and to do a change of frame of reference, of course not. In a way, you know, the act of projecting the 3D graphics on the screen, you know, is a change of frame of reference that basically flattens everything into a two-dimensional plane, which is kind of interesting. But it's not linear, so it's not just a matrix. There's this thing that I've always called the transform sandwich, okay? So Imagine that I have a transform that does something in some frame of reference, and I want to transform it into the matrix that does the same transform, but in a different frame of reference. Are you following me? So, again, you know, a matrix, you know, just does something to vectors, right? So imagine that I have a matrix that transforms a banana, right, into an apple, okay? It just does whatever it needs to do to make the banana more round like the apple, right? Okay? That's a perfectly valid kind of transformation. Now imagine that, I mean, the transformation has to be expressed with numbers. Once you have numbers, you have a frame of reference. You might not know what it is, but you have it, okay? Because the numbers always refer to some frame of reference. So once you have that matrix, okay, imagine that you don't want it in the frame of reference in which it has been expressed, okay? You can transform it into a different frame of reference. And you do it by performing this calculation here. One way to visualize this is, you know, with the share. Remember the share? What it does is kind of, you know, stretches non-uniformly, and you know, a free space, a mesh, right? So, but the way we expressed it, you know, with the 1-1 and the H in the bottom left of the matrix, that was in 2D, right? The way we express it like that is just a share along the horizontal, right? So it moves things along the horizontal by different amounts depending on what the vertical is, okay? Transforms this into this. Now imagine that I want a share that transforms... Now imagine that I want this share not in this frame of reference, okay, but in some other frame of reference, like so I have a share, you know, this in this frame of reference, x and y, and the matrix is 1, 1, 0. HX. Okay? I have the matrix. Now, I want this frame of reference. How do I find the matrix that performs this exact same transformation but in this frame of reference? If you think relative, you can twist your viewpoint around and say, oh, in this frame of reference, it's something that transforms this square into that thing, right? Okay? So the way you do that is you take this R, which is the matrix that transforms between those two frames of reference, and you multiply it on either side, and one of them inverted. Okay? In a way, it's like taking these coordinates here, which are expressed in this frame of reference. These coordinates here that are expressed. These coordinates here that are expressed in this frame of reference. You know, transforming them so that they are expressed in this one, performing the share, and then moving back to the original frame of reference. Okay. And we will be doing, you know, quite a bit of this when we talk about skeletal animations and things like that. Because there are lots of frames of reference in that case. this is another one, another way of visualizing it. Okay, we want to find a matrix of ESM prime that transforms vertices in some frame of reference. So what we do is we multiply by the matrix that takes those into the frame of reference in which the transformation has been expressed, apply the transformation, and then move back to the original frame of reference. Okay? I think we're ready for a break. So we'll finish after the break. You know, this type of stuff, you know, it's kind of hard to see these dry, but it has plenty of practical applications when we do 3D graphics. So I want you to at least have been exposed to it. In the raw form. Who here would say that, you know, they got it? 1, 2, yeah.
I have a math degree.
Huh? You have a math degree, so. Yeah. I can't take credit for that, though. I cannot take credit for that, though. No, this type of stuff is kind of hard because we're trying to visualize stuff to understand what our matrices are doing, and it is hard. There's no way around that.
Yeah, one thing to remember is always, you know, remember, like you said, remember what something is in reference to,
mm-hmm.
and that can include whether it's a left-handed XYZ or a right-handed XYZ. If you remember, Dan had those Tinker Toys by XYZ. You always remember which way you're going because it can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Or it will make a difference.
Yeah. In the end, the trick is to find the right operations to apply to get the desired result. And sometimes it does take just fumbling with it, you know, if you don't completely grasp all the concepts. Hmm. I have done a lot by trial and error in my time. So yeah. Okay, so let's reconvene at 10 to 8. Mm-hmm. What? You can. Honestly, Mercurial, I've tried to use it a couple times. My repositories have always started rotting for some reason. I'm sure I'm doing things wrong, but anyway, as long as I just have to like pull down stuff, I probably will be able to. But I might need help. Just so you know. I know. That's what I use. I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, I did a few changes in a computer. I did now another few changes in another computer, and then trying to merge them, I found no way. It's like it was always complaining about something or some other. So, but just for pulling down what you have, it should be okay. As long as your repository is okay, and I just pull it, it should be fine. Right. Hey, I was the only one submitting in that case, but from two computers.
Okay.
You know, and I figured, hey, you know, I'm doing two computers. This thing is distributed. You know, it should work fine.
Yeah.
And it probably does if you don't do bad things or something. I don't know. I mean, I ended up, I don't know, I was basically trying to, you know, merge the paths.
Yeah.
And
I've done it on multiple laptops,
but I couldn't get, like, one version that had all the changes in, you know, that the system would accept.
Yeah.
It just wasn't happening for some reason.
Yeah, I just started using it for this course. So I've never done anything like complicated, like mergers or anything. But I've used multiple computers. And, but my workflow is always just pull down, you know, think, you know, if it was anything.
Yeah. If all else fails, just juggle too. That's a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yeah, now and then just copy all the files to the other one and submit. But yeah, I should be able to. I have it installed.
Yeah.
Just the tortoise SG, but he's a funny guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's see, he lives in a very different world than I do, in many ways, in more than one. You know, he's very much the like game designer, idea man type. He is involved in the games.
Yeah.
You know, he's not just. I mean, he's very good about promoting them. You know, he's one of the best promoters I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I mean, people bitch and moan about his games, but then, you know, they just eat them up anyway, somehow.
Yeah.
Or at least they get notoriety for some way or another. But, yeah, I mean, he's a funky guy. I haven't dealt with him much. But I was working with the developers, basically, in the pit. Yeah, Guildford.
Yeah,
Guildford, England. Sorry. Unless they've moved since, I mean, this was years ago. Yeah, it was one of the first things I did at Microsoft.
That wasn't your first production game, though, right? That wasn't your first, mass-produced game, was it?
No. No, the first mass-produced game that's not just something sold only in Spain was called Armor Command, and it was not that much mass production because you probably never heard of it. It was one of the first 3D real-time strategy games out there. It had its strength and its weakness was a very distinctive user interface. You know, the way you control all your units, and usually you think real-time strategy and you're like, okay, click, drag, kill this guy, right? Click, drag, kill that guy, that sort of thing. But we did this immersive. You are within the action. So this was more, you know, less units and more control the unit and tell the unit go here and then there from the unit's point of view, right? And, you know, grouping units and, you know, basically designating a leader and then telling the leader where to go, that sort of thing. But it was a very interesting game. But yeah, it didn't sell much, basically. Then, it didn't sell much, no. But yeah, I mean, I did the 3D engine for that game, basically, including the software renderer, because back then 3D hardware was not common. And then, you know, I was working at a company called Running Entertainment in the Bay Area. And then we made a game with LucasArts, which is also based there, which is Force Commander, which is a bit of the same thing. You know, it's a 3D real-time strategy, but, you know, with a normal interface. And, you know, in the Star Wars universe, which is fun to work with. Yeah, we kind of, you know, we got to put Jedis in there and everything. So, oh, it's already past the hour. Is everybody here? I guess so. See you. I've been talking and didn't finish my apple. That's fine. I'll just put it here for later. Okay, I'm going to take time now out of this. There. That's actually a very good stopping point over there. So we're going to switch gears a little bit. We will continue with the math review. You can go ahead and read the slides if you want. You know, they're in the website. But they go into more and more esoteric elements of mathematics in 3D graphics. And again, we will talk about them. Now I wanted to talk to you a little bit about 2D rendering, because that's what we're going to do for the homework. 2D rendering is nice because it allows me to, you know, establish a good way to work with D3D with you. There are good ways and there are bad ways, and usually you stumble into bad ways if you're not careful. The main idea about this is to manage the state of the stuff that you draw correctly. So we're going to learn about all the basic states that you use in two-dimensional rendering using D3D. And, you know, just we'll see how to render images, and, you know, we will see a little bit about the fixed pixel pipeline. You know, just basically how to do things, okay? So these are the main D3D calls that you're going to have to deal with. You know, these are all in the device, D3D device, okay? We're going to render 2D kind of like the buttons that you've put in your game projects, hopefully using DXCT calls, you know, that give you the buttons to switch debug cameras and things like that. But we're not going to use any of that. We're going to go directly into D3D. Okay. The most important one is set render state. You know, it just sets global state. Okay. Your D3D device, the thing that you're going to use to render, is a sort of single-threaded machine, okay? And you program it in everything in sequence, okay? So the idea is you just set state, you know, give it the matrices that it needs, the colors that it needs, the textures that it needs, and then tell it to draw, okay? So first state, set in the state, is just global state. And there are a lot of them. The vast majority of them are dealing with light calculations in what's called the fixed function pipeline. Okay. Specifically, a predetermined lighting model that D3D implements for you. It's basic, but it serves its purpose well. When you render 3D objects, you can have them lit, and you know they look kind of nice. But there's a lot of state that goes into that. You know, you just ignore all of those. Okay. We'll use a few others. Set pixel shader. We use it to make sure that there is no pixel shader set in the device. There are. Same as there is a fixed function that deals with lighting, there is another fixed function that deals with, you know, like final treating of the colors of the pixels. The lighting fixed function pipeline deals with lighting on the vertices only. Okay, and then just interpolates the values within a triangle. So we're not going to use pixel shaders yet. Believe me, you will use them quite a bit, okay? Set FBF. FBF means fixed vertex format, flexible vertex format, sorry. It just tells D3D, you know, how your vertices are laid out, what they have, right? Do they have colors? Do they have texture coordinates? That sort of thing. Set texture to set texture images. You can set more than one for a single draw call. And then the pixel shader or the fixed function pixel pipeline, which is the thing that goes instead of it, you know, determines what to do with the colors that it gets for those textures. And that sets set sampler state. That specifies how the texture will be sampled from. So for every point on the screen that is touched by a mesh, a value will be taken from the texture. So that indicates how that's done. And then set texture stage state, which indicates once you have a value from the texture, you know how that is used. Okay? I mean, the separation is not tremendously precise. Because, for instance, this is the state that says where the coordinates are taken from is actually from here. But anyway, D3D is not perfect, especially not D3D9. Okay. And then, you know, we can deal with clear. Clear just fills the region of the screen with a single value and draw primitive UP. Okay, there are several draw functions. You know, this is the one that we're going to use for now. Okay. It's recently come to my attention that I'm missing here set vertex shader, which is the same thing. You know, basically, we want to not have a vertex shader, so we call it with a null. I'll fix the slide. So global configuration. You know, whenever you're doing 2D graphics, usually you do not want to be using Z-buffers. Z-buffers are done to resolve occlusion of 3D meshes. This is 2D. 2D is best done using what's called the painter's algorithm, which is drawing things in the order in which you want them occluding what has been drawn before. It's called the painter's algorithm, I assume, because, you know, when you're a painter, you can draw the background and then, you know, you draw some person on top of the background and it overwrites it. And you do that in order, basically. When you're dealing with transparency and translucency and things like that, you know, it's important to do things in order anyway. And 2D graphics have a lot of that. We also don't want to be writing to the Z-buffer because, well, there's nothing useful to be gained from that. And usually you set the call mode to none. Call mode is saying, hey, my triangles, render them only from one side but not from the other, right? That's done so that if you have a mesh, imagine that, you know, this bottle is a mesh, okay? The triangles that are here at the back, okay, right now are kind of visible because the bottle is transparent, right? But if the bottle were opaque, there would be no point in rendering anything back here if you are looking at it from there, okay? And that's most easily done by not rendering anything from one side, rendering only from the other side, okay? Yeah, well, there's all sorts of interesting things that happen when you render a triangle from either side indistinctly. Imagine you have a flag waving in the wind, right? That flag is going to have some lighting model applied to it, because otherwise it looks kind of weird. You know, you want it to have, like, you know, darker and brighter parts of it as it waves, right? Following the lighting model. Well, you know, the lighting model applies differently to one side than to the other. And that is kind of weird if, you know, you're rendering exactly the same triangle from both sides, right? So, anyway, usually, you know, when you do things like that, you know, you tend to have two triangles, one facing each way. It's, you know, a different way. Even though, you know, they are coplanar, they're exactly the same one. Just so that you can do different lighting calculations on either side. But for 2D graphics, you know, it's better just not to have to worry about, are my triangles clockwise or counterclockwise? You know, it's just easier not to deal with it. Okay. We disable the pixel shader with a null, also the vertex shader. You know, we're not going to use any of that. And then, I started rearranging and I forgot to remove this. That's what you get for new slides. They were not here last year. Another very important global state is alpha blending. You know, what do you do with the alpha values, right? Your textures have colors, right? Red, green, and blue. And also there is a fourth channel. Because computers like four a lot, you know, it's going to be there, whether you use it or not. That's not entirely true all the time, but enough for now. So you have a fourth component. That fourth component is called alpha, and usually it's used for opacity. You know, you probably know that already. Opacity means that an alpha of ranges between 0 and 1, you know, a value of 1 means it's completely opaque, you know, what you're rendering. A value of 0 means it's completely transparent, which means it's not rendered at all, okay? Any value in between means it's kind of translucent. You can see a little bit of that and a little bit of the background. And you use that to render the bottle the way it is, okay? Because the bottle, you can kind of see it. Okay, but you can see through it too. Okay? So, in order to do this sort of transparency, okay, having that value, those alpha values in your texture means that different parts of your image can be more transparent than others, which is great. You know, just imagine a magnifying glass or something, you know, like, that is transparent in some places and translucent in some others and opaque in some others, like the frame. You can just have that as an image. And the alpha values say what's more translucent and what is less translucent. And for every pixel, the GPU will make a computation depending on what you set here. Okay. This separate alpha blend enable, you don't care, is kind of advanced. Okay. It's only used in very, very rare cases. The alpha blend enable, you set it to true, so that it does a transparency based on alpha. And then these source blend and destination blend, those are the typical values that you use for just regular alpha blend transparency. What this means is that the source alpha gets multiplied by the source color. Okay, so when the alpha is 1, means that the source color, which is what comes out of your geometry, is completely transferring into the screen. The destination blend is the inverse, which means 1 minus the alpha, because alpha is between 0 and 1. Okay, so the inverse is 1 minus alpha. And that gets multiplied by what's in the background. So with an alpha of 1, you know, the background is completely eliminated by multiplying with 0. And vice versa. You know, for an alpha of 0, the background completely remains. So basically those are the values. And then this add is just says what is done with those two. You know, multiply alpha by the source blend. By the source color, and multiply the inverse of the alpha by the destination color, and then add them together, and that's the color that ends. That's just the way alpha transparency works. If you realize that is a lerp, okay, if you know what that is. If not, we'll talk about it when we finish the slides for math. In order to disable alpha test, for now I recommend that you disable alpha testing, but there are some nice uses for that. You know, what that is instead of doing a lerp based on alpha, it's just let the pixels pass or not depending on some threshold value of that alpha. But for now we can just not do it. And then we need to actually make up some geometry for our 2D graphics. 2D graphics are typically going to be just rectangles. You have your screen here, okay? You want to render something here. And those here will have transparency maybe, right? Which is determined by a texture. But you're actually going to render a rectangle, okay? And so in order to render that rectangle, you have to generate the geometry, okay? The recommendation is that you use this flexible vertex format, which is XYZRHW, which allows you to just pass on screen coordinates in pixels, okay? So this is in pixels, 20, 100, okay? And this is the general layout in order to do that. You could have more stuff, and then you would need to add more fields to these flexible vertex format. Usually the two that you are that you might put there is D3D, FVF, underscore, diffuse. That means a color, 4 bytes, which make up a color, or you know, 1 D word, which makes up a color. Okay. And that can be used to colorize, you know, the pixels. And then D3D, FVF, PEX1, which means one set of coordinates, which is 2 floats, right? And that indicates what texture coordinates to use at the corners of the rectangle, of the corresponding corners. Okay. The idea here is these are just bits that you add into a mask over here. Okay. the order in which they have to be present in these structures, and whatever vertex structure you use, you know, it's all predetermined. Okay, so first position, then color, if you have any, then texture coordinates. Yes. The help is typically sufficient, but not as a methodical learning tool in any way. You know, you can find just about everything there. Sometimes, you know, it can be hard to find, or things are a little, you know, sometimes they leave things implied. They assume that you know about 3D graphics, that sort of thing. Sometimes they go and try to explain it, everything from the very beginning. So it's a little uneven in that sense. Mm. Unfortunately, I can't really recommend, you know, the best book for specifically Direct3D for you, you know, if you wanted a book. The problem is, I've never used one. that's basically all I have to say about that. So I don't know which one is best and which one isn't, you know, in order to, you know, have a more methodical type introduction to D3D. I know that, you know, there's this book written by Luna. I don't remember the name, though, or the publisher. I know that they've been used in past years in the first course as the textbook, so I don't know this year. But, you know, at least those are books intended to teach you to use Direct3D. Okay. Ultimately, we all tend to learn from samples and for trying and failing and trying again.
Yeah, I just have some questions about the great device, reset device, lost device.
Yeah, so managing the device, okay, is something that the game projects don't do because, well, not directly, because DXUT kind of takes care of some of the gritty details of that.
You know. What takes care of that?
DXUT. That is the framework that Direct3D samples use, and Dan's project was also built on top of that. You know, that takes care of creating the device, takes care of tracking, you know, what needs to be done with the device. Fortunately, for Direct3D 11, 10, and especially 11, that has been greatly simplified. You know, all that management. You know, it's been rationalized a lot more. So you know, that's good news for people, except that it doesn't work in Windows XP. And it's one of the reasons why we just don't use it here. Plain and simple. Okay. You'll see that the homework, you know, the first homework kind of has two parts. You know, the main part is based on a little game that I made. And in there you can find, you know, a way to just not use DXCT and just manage the device a little bit. It does not manage lost devices, for instance. But it does manage the creation and, you know, figuring out texture formats and things like that. So, and it's kind of neat because it's about 1,000 lines of code, so it's readable to some degree. Okay. So once we set up, you know, we come up with the vertices of our rectangle, and we set up the format to D3D so it knows how to read this. That's basically what this does. Then we just render it, you know, and that's just the draw primitive UP call triangle strip. What it does is it makes, you know, takes those four vertices over there and makes a rectangle out of them. Okay. It does more than that, but you know, this for now this is good. This two means it's going to be two triangles, because one rectangle is two triangles, right? One and two. And then we just give it the pointer to the vertices and the size of one of them, so it knows how to go from one to the next. That's all. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, the set FVF only says the data that we want D3D to use out of that vertex format. So this structure could have stuff at the end that is used sometimes and not some other times. Mm-hmm. The idea being that we don't want to have two copies of that. Mm-hmm. Of course, in this case, it doesn't matter, because this is just a little array that we cook up directly in the code. You know, that's basically how we do it. But when you have like 3D meshes that you know, spaceship, right? 3D mesh, then you might want to do, for instance, two passes on that. You know, like first render and then polish, right? And you don't want to have two copies of the data. So in that case, you put all the data for two passes in one structure. And then you tell D3D on the first pass, you take things from here, here, and here, and in the second pass, from here, here, and there, right? If that makes sense. This flexible vertex format, we'll stop using it relatively soon when we start talking about shaders. We'll talk about vertex declarations, which is a complex version of this, where you specifically state every single field in the structure where it is. This is just a quick way, older way. They removed it in D3, 10, 11. They removed a whole bunch of stuff that was old and... There's only shaders there. Okay. So, another thing that we need to do, and you know, of course we need to do this before the actual geometry, another thing we need to do is set up texture. And for that, we need to set up which texture we're going to draw in this rectangle, and then we need to set up the filters, how that texture is going to be filtered, and how the texture coordinates are going to be handled when they are out of bounds. That's what this is. Okay. Again, we'll talk about all these in more detail, but for now this is good stuff. The only thing that sometimes is better is to, instead of linear, to have point in here. Okay. But sometimes you can avoid distortions that way. Anyway, we'll talk about those in more detail. I even have a homework where you can implement them, but that will be for later. And then you set all this stuff, the texture stage state. Texture stage states are a sort of calculator, okay, that you program, okay? It has other stuff like the texture coordinate index, which says, if you have multiple sets of texture coordinates and you have multiple textures, which one go with which, right? So this index over here has to match this index over here, right? Which all refers to the same thing. You can have up to 8 textures. And you can even have a stage state, with some index here that you don't set a texture for. Okay. The reason is that these three states here specify an operation to do on every pixel. This is the operation itself. Modulate means multiply. Okay. That's one example. And these are which arguments to multiply. Argument one is the texture, which means the color taken from here. And this other one is current, which means, you know, whatever came from the previous stage in the pipeline. Because this is the first one, okay, it's basically whatever color you had in the vertices that was interpolated. This is an operation to do on the alpha values, which can be separate from the color values. Because they're so different, it doesn't make sense to always have the same operation for both. In this case, I'm saying, oh, just take the alpha from the color component that was in the vertex, the one selected by these 3DF, VF, diffuse. So the alpha component from that will end up in the pixels. Okay, that alpha comes from the vertices. So you have 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they just get interpolated in the middle. Okay? So you need to disable the first one that is not used for anything. You have up to 8 of them, okay, and you kind of program them like this in case you want to do like fun and interesting things. So like imagine that each one of those blocks is one index, like 0, 1, and 2. Okay. And this one has an image. Okay. This one has another image. Okay. Selected like this over there. Okay. Imagine that this one doesn't have an image for whatever reason. Okay. What this does is this is an operation between whatever comes from this texture and whatever comes from the previous stage. Again, we start with the color from here. If there is any. If there is none, then you know you shouldn't use it. And the result of this operation, you know, if it's modulate, that's multiply the components, component by component. Red with red, green with green. If you see add, that's add them together. And there are others. There's this one, select argument one, which means just copy something. Okay. So again, the output from the first stage goes as the input, the current of the second stage. And so on. There is also a blend. There's also a constant value that you can set. So you can say, add 0.2 to all the colors or things like that. Okay, so you can set a constant on the stages. I forgot what the actual state is called. You can just select another operation here, and then the final result from all those will be the color of the pixel. And this is run for all the pixels. Okay. It is a little primitive, but you can do pretty crazy things with it sometimes. You know, if you are.
So for those who sound really familiar with that, what I did is the base screen area is with the texture, and I just changed the V value to the red, and then manipulated the texture.
Yeah, that thing used two things. One of them. Not clamp here. Wrap. Okay, clamp means, you know, if the coordinate is outside of the texture, okay, then just take the closest pixel in the texture. So it's kind of like, you know, the edges of the texture get smeared to infinity. Wrap means, oh, just put another copy of the texture, and another, you know, repeat it forever, in every direction. Okay. So what that did is, if you have a texture kind of like this, then when you repeat it, you get this, and this, and so on. And then, yeah, manipulating the coordinates allows you to just do it. Yeah. Again. Yeah. That's not using any of this trickery. It's just setting values here, calculating values and putting them there, you know, which is perfectly fine. I mean, when you have a rectangle, which is a sprite, say spaceship, you know, you're doing one of those vertical shooters, right? And you have a spaceship that's shooting and so on. And you move him around, right? Because you're playing the game. Okay, that's just changing the coordinates of the rectangle, right? You know, you keep the width, you know, the difference between the small x and the big x, and you keep the height, the difference between the small y and the big y. You know, you keep those constant, but then, you know, just move the coordinates around. Nice and easy. Okay. So, that's that. I mean, this is the more complicated part of it. You don't really need it to finish the homework. You don't really need to do anything special here. The only thing you might need is not use current here for the alpha, because, you know, that ignores completely the alpha that comes from the texture, and you don't want that, right? So I'll let you kind of figure out what it is. There's a lot of state here, okay? I mean, there are page after page of state involved in getting tiny little rectangle when they're on the screen, okay? That is normal. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about state management. Because, I mean, imagine in your games, right? So at some point you say, DXUT, you know, render my UI elements, you know. You have no clue what DXUT is going to do with the state of the device, right? When that function returns, you have no clue what any of these states is set to, okay? It is very, very easy to miss some state that actually is used in rendering your primitives, whatever it is that you're rendering, okay? Game developers out there, they deal with this problem in various ways, okay? But it always boils down to, you know, managing the state in some way. One possibility is every function in your game, okay, has to save the current value of all the states that it overwrites and then restore it before it returns. You have set texture state state, you also have get texture state state. Okay? And that allows you to obtain all of this, the current state of the device. Okay? But doing that is kind of wasteful. But it's kind of like saying, hey, you know, I'm a function that renders something. I want to protect myself against the environment, okay? I want to protect myself against the rest of the game, okay? And it's, in some ways, the safest way of making sure that what you get is what you thought you were going to get when you made, you know, your little function that renders something, okay? So that's one way. Another way is saying, hey, in this game, every single function sets all the state that it depends on. And that requires knowing about, you know, what you're rendering. For instance, all those when we talked about, you know, set render state, the first one, the one that does all the globals, I said that the vast majority of them deal with lighting. Okay. Do you need to overwrite them with something in this, you know, when you're doing this and just rendering a 2D rectangle on the screen? Yes or no? No? Why?
Because they're not being used.
Why are not they being used?
Well, we are,
what state is disabling them?
The default.
Nope.
Oh, no, there was one for disabling lighting.
There is one for disabling lighting. D3DRS underscore light enable. You say the false, and then all those are disabled by definition. In this case, this also disables them, you know, using XYZRHW, the one that allows you to set screen coordinates. That automatically disables those. Because those are supposed to be part, you know, participate in the part of the device that would calculate this. But you're saying, no, you're not calculating anything. You know, I'm giving you the final result. So, okay. So, also, in here, you know, D3DFVF underscore normal is missing. And that's also a big indication that there is no lighting to be done. So all those states will not do anything in that case. But again, you know, all those things, I can't go through all the combinations with you. You know, I'm just saying, you know, just be a little mindful. If you have any doubts, just slam them with values. Every single last one of them. Just go to the documentation, you know, D3D render state. You know, there's an enumeration. It has a lot of them. Just write them with whatever it says default. Make a function that just slams every single last state in the entire device. That's one way. Because not even I know all the dependencies within there. Yeah. One thing that makes Direct3D 11 so great is that there are not 1,000 different discrete states. You know, there are like 5 of them. Okay. And what you do is you create a state object and you say, you know, set this state object. And that groups a whole bunch of them. That simplified state management a lot. Because now the runtime, you know, says, oh, you know, you can set the same one 1,000 times and it'll be extremely fast because I know it's the same one for all of them. And, you know, there are only like, you know, 5 or 6 different state blocks that you set. So, and those state blocks, do you create them and then they are immutable.
And blocks kind of correspond to the 1,000 different things we can set.
Yeah, like this, you know, it's just one single call, which is pretty nice. You know, it makes it easier to just slam them all. Okay. My recommendation for you is to follow the guide here and, you know, set at the very least everything that you see here to something. Okay. Figure out what's the best for you. The homework, well, this is just instructions for submission. Be sure to read every single last one of them. Basically, what I'm saying is don't be late. You know, use Subversion if you at all can. I can set up a server for you if you want. That is absolutely no problem for me. Okay? And it's by far the easiest way for me to deal with your submissions. Much better than email. So I'm getting you 2 points. Okay. before the final grade if you do that. Just as a way of encouraging. Okay, there are plenty of other, like, you know, subversion servers out there that you can use, or you can just ask me. Okay. Don't be late. And don't be late. Okay. Seriously, I.
When you're at the library, you have a laptop.
Yes, I have this laptop there. Yeah, I mean, if you want to come to the library, so in case anybody hasn't read it, you know, on Tuesdays from 6 to 8, I volunteer at the Redmond Library. That volunteering means if there are kids that need help with homework, I need to help them, otherwise I'm just sitting there. So I'm saying, I'm offering you the opportunity to come in and chat with me or ask me questions, or show me your program that doesn't work, so I can maybe try to help you, okay? From 8 to 9, I have no volunteering duties any longer, but the library is still open. So if anybody is there at 8, I will stay with them until 9, if you want to, okay? So that's kind of my office hours. Okay. Please use them if you want and can. I am aware that maybe not everybody is able to be there at those times, and I am sorry, but you know, we all have day jobs and other duties. So, also the homework is not due until Saturday of next week, so we'll have one class in the middle. So you can always catch me there. I'm pretty certain of it. Besides all these little links, I hope from year to year they go bad, some of them, and I remove them and so on. If you see any that's bad, then let me know, so I can fix it. So the homework here is I'm giving you a game, a version of Bejeweled, which I'm sure most of you or all of you know what it is. Just a simple kind of game. Let's just run it. Here. So together with the game, in this pack, I give you an executable so you can see what it looks like. Okay, it is seriously non-pretty. That's because I am a developer. I am a programmer. I am not a artist, okay? In any way possible, I'm not an artist. But I grabbed a little program called paint.net, and I played with it a little bit, and I came up with a few graphics, okay? With alpha channels, so they have transparencies, which are, you know, just look fine. So, and then the game is just match the jewels, right? And let more jewels fall and do chains, and there is no score or anything. You know, it's not meant to be a lot of fun to play, although you could find yourself 3-4 minutes later that you're still playing. But yeah, it is kind of addicting, and this one has no score, I reserved a little space for score. They're quite good around implementing it, and it doesn't need it for this homework anyway, so there you go. You can go ahead and do it if you want. and yeah, it's just a little game with a few sprites, okay? It's got three kinds of things that it renders. It renders the background. It renders those sprites. Then it renders that little rotating selection circle. Whenever you click on one of them, okay? And those are three functions that you must implement, okay? If you compile it, you will see that it just flashes. It flashes because it's split in between two buffers, okay? And those buffers are never written with anything because the functions are empty. You know, so you must fix it. And that's that for that. Anybody have any questions? Huh? Not yet? Yeah. So go ahead and look at it. You know, the game itself is a little sample on how to render something with the 3D, you know, like a functioning game in less than 1,000 lines. So, you know, you might find it interesting just for that, you know, to produce the code. I'm not entirely fully proud of every single line of code, but it is not bad. There is extra grade for the homework assignment, which this one Alex remembers, I think. So this was a basic assignment last year. You know, I decided to just make it extra grade. So the idea is you have your game, right? Your game that you worked on last year. And the idea is just to make a little minimap for it. I mean, you guys know a minimap, right? You know, you have your screen. You know, with your maze and everything, and here is Tiny or whatever your main character, you know, your player character is in your game. You know, and this is a maze, so it's got obstacles and things around. So the minimap is just saying, oh, let's render, you know, a little circle over there, you know, that the center of it represents the player position, you know, this guy. And it just shows where the obstacles are, right, relative to the player. The easiest way is to create a texture that matches your level.grd file, right, matches your maze and represents it. Just create the texture in with whatever paint program you prefer. If you don't have any paint programs, by the way, I seriously recommend paint.net. It's small and powerful, you know, for doing simple things. It's not Photoshop, but it's the things that you would most use from Photoshop put in one little program. So, and it's free, so it's easy to recommend. So you would, like, you know, draw your map here, like, you know, the default project uses the map that Dan made for the last assignment solution. So, which is just, you know, it has walls over here and then, like, 5 obstacles there or something like that. Okay, so you just create a texture that represents that accurately. And then, you know, have it fill a circle in there. And there are 2 strategies that I describe in the page on how you might do that. Or if you want for extra grade, you can just do anything else in your game, okay? That uses all these concepts, you know, particularly when there's some 2D graphics on it, health bars or things like that. Okay? Any questions about that?
So this is due next Saturday also?
Yeah, this is just extra credit for this assignment. Honestly, the basic assignment is quite guided as it is. So it should not be difficult for you to do. Once you've done that, and please do that first. Always do the basic assignment at least. Then, you know, just go ahead and play with your game and see how you would, you know, use those functions in here and, you know, render stuff. Or maybe make more interesting ones. Okay? Okay. So, just for the rest of the class, I'm just going to play a little. Well, not really, I mean, not just play. So, actually, maybe I should have done this first. Yes.
There's one thing I get from 402 that all of my kids.
Make Warrior 2? Make Assault 2? Or Make Warrior? Yeah. Oh, Make Assault, that game gave us so much trouble.
Well, it has mechs, and there's also this small man-sized one, a fallacy or something.
Make Warrior 2 has Windows.
Yeah, that's Make Assault. That's Make Assault 2. Yeah.
Yeah,
Make Assault 2. I played that game a lot, trying to get it to run on the 360, and in the end it kind of did, but you know, it did some strange things. All I'm going to say about it, many games did strange things. You know, we found a couple of games that figured out a way to compress geometry that in such a way that the GPU would decompress it on the fly. It just boggles the mind what some game developers do when they start reverse engineering things and figuring things out and playing with values. Oh, what if I put a 1 here? Oh, you know, it's just crazy. It's just crazy sometimes. Oh, why don't I get my widescreen? Let's just change it. Okay, so first thing to note, this is all about looking at games and things and graphics being rendered for real. And, you know, you see the kind of things that you can do just with 2D graphics, right? You know, a little icon over here, buttons over there, my face over there in avatar form, and then the menus. Mm-hmm. One thing to actually kind of realize from here is sometimes the simplest graphics, you know, can look kind of nice just by moving them appropriately. Okay, and that's an art. Okay, I can't teach you that. I could teach you techniques, things that you can do and try, but I don't really know how to put together something, an experience that feels awesome. Okay, it's not my expertise. But you can at least see things like, you know, the timing of things, you know, that can make an interface like this seem fluid and interesting. You know, I mean, just figuring out exactly, you know, when to start shrinking one pane, enlarging the other one, you know, while you're moving, right? It's kind of one of those things that can give you pause a little bit. And the execution of that is very easy. You know, it's just increasing the values at this particular point in time or not. But, you know, that can make an okay game or an okay interface or experience, can make it more awesome. So it's something, especially for those of you who are more like design oriented, you know, it's kind of nice to just see and try to deal with. So, game library. Oh yeah. You can't get this pet anymore. You know, the game that it came with is no longer available. You know, little dragon. So yeah. I have it, and you can't. it's just neat, you know. It's just a neat thing to add. You know, just a little dragon flying around. You got this from the Destination Arcade app, which my team at Microsoft, my current team, built. That was supposed to be an experience built around the pivot, you know, the pivot control. Implemented on Xbox and for browsing your Xbox Live Arcade games. A little experiment on UI design, and we just released it there for the Summer of Arcade, which finished, of course, because summer is already gone. So we discontinued that app. But basically, if you found any game that had dragons in it, it would get granted you that little item as an achievement. So it was easy if you knew what to do, which I did, because I'm an insider, I guess. I wanted to go to some like 2D games, just to look at them. Some of you don't really play much, so this might be more new to you. Some others might really know about these games because they tend to be notorious in one way or another. This game is an evolution of a game that was created for the Xbox One. And that game was intended and included as a mini game, a hidden mini game in a racing game in the original Xbox, in Project Gotham 2. There was this garage where you had your cars and so on, and you could find it there. It was hidden, but it's just a game that has nothing to do with racing. But they created it, and they thought it was awesome, and they didn't know what to do with it, so they put it there. Eventually, the Xbox Live Arcade stuff, which is the small games that you download on the Xbox, that thing came out, so they put it there as a standalone game, and everybody liked it. The game is very minimalistic with the graphics. It just uses this 2D kind of neon style type graphics. How would you do that neon? Like, you see, there's a glow around the letters. The letters are just straight lines, but there's a glow around them. How would you do that? What do you think? Anybody have any ideas? Well, they might be doing it with shaders, but they don't have to. Texture and alpha lens. There's nothing more than that. Okay? There's nothing more needed. The alpha lens mode that I showed you there in the slides is a straight alpha lens. But there are other modes that make sense in various contexts. One of them is the modulate mode, okay, which means, take the color of the geometry that's being rendered and the color that's in the background and multiply them together. If you've ever used one of those 3D glasses, the red and blue or whatever colors, okay, that type of transparency is actually like that. It's multiplying a blue color to whatever is behind. Because when you look through it, you see what's behind, but you see it only blue. If you've seen one of those gizmos or whatchamacallits, where you have a drawing, of like random lines, but if you like put a red transparent thing on top of it, suddenly you can make out words or something specific in that jumble. That's just because when you put that red, the red transparent cellophane on top or whatever it is, everything that is white and everything that is red blends together. And everything that is yellow also blends together. And everything that's like magenta or pinkish violet type colors, they kind of blend into the red, and everything else remains. If you have green, it ends up black. So what it does is it distorts different colors in different ways, so suddenly you can make out, and it distorts them like that. Basically any color that has a red component keeps that red component, and everything else turns black. So that's one mode, and it's just multiplying source by destination colors. There is another mode, which is adding them together instead of multiplying. And that's the mode that's being used here. It's the mode that makes things shine, bright, like neon-type bright or fire-type bright. Whenever you see, the laser coming out of the spaceship, You know, it's usually additive transparency. It does not use the alpha component. Neither of those two modes use the alpha component. They don't need it. It just uses one color and the other color. Okay. So yeah, I mean, you can just have a texture which is the H, right, little texture, and then you can have another texture which is the H but very blurred. And it's basically the glow of the H. And then you can make that glow, you know, appear more or less by modulating it with something. And that's basically how you would do it. That's the easiest way by far. There is another way, which is easy in that it takes less work to do a lot of stuff in that mode, which is to do a post-process. So just draw everything without the glows, and then, you know, like, blur the glows out of the image. And many games, you know, in Xbox 360 and in PlayStation and in PCs, you know, many games do that sort of thing. They call it the bloom filter. You know, they makes everything bright. You know, have a more of a halo around it. So yeah, I mean, this game is not really, you know, that revolutionary in that it does crazy things with the graphics, but what it does really, really well. For instance, how would you think that they make the background warp like that when you shoot? Exactly. It doesn't take any more than that. All it takes is rendering these grid here, which you can't see all the time, but it's there. Okay, render it as a grid of triangles. So instead of drawing the whole thing as two triangles, okay, what you do is you split it. You say, oh, it's a grid of triangles like this, right? And then you twiddle with the coordinates, either the positions of the corners or the texture coordinates, you know, whatever looks best. You know, it does take experimentation to get whatever looks best. But yeah, I mean, everything can be done that way in this game, pretty much everything. And it's just 2D, and it pretty much just uses what we've seen, pretty much, or can be done just like that, okay? Well, we have to look which button does what in those screens. Let's see, we don't have a lot of time, but you know, a more traditional kind of, you know, bling-based game, you know, is something like this. This was quite popular. It's like a role-playing game, but its main mechanic is the Bejeweled game. you know, you are some sort of sorcerer or mage or warrior, and you're fighting zombies and skeletons and goblins and all that stuff. And whenever you fight one of them, it's just a battle in a bejeweled board. And it's all 2D again. It's got menus and... Oh no. It didn't save. Why? Oh, because I'm not logged in. I apologize, I bought this game and now it doesn't know. And that is because I have a slight licensing problem with it. But anyway, whatever, we got through all that stuff. Yeah. Come on. Okay. Battle some rats that do not fight back, so it's kind of silly, but whatever. Again, this is just Bejeweled. You know, the board that I gave you is 10 by 10, this is 8 by 8, but, you know, whatever. There's a lot that goes into figuring out the best composition of tools and board size and all that. So I can match skulls, and he gets hit, and so on. And, you know, you can see the kinds of little, you know, special effects that they do around. Let's see, I need blues. I want to do that. Nah, this is hopeless. Okay, whatever. No, they don't do anything. I'm sorry. I kind of played a few so that we could get into a more interesting kind of dynamic there, but, you know, it didn't save.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's just a dual
field that maybe both. Yes. I mean, the idea of this game is you both manipulate in turns.
Yeah.
So, and all the different colors of jewels are mana, and then you have spells. You know, when you get enough mana to cast a spell, you can choose to cast a spell instead of playing the board. And the spells do different things, and it gets interesting because, you know, you build up your character with a combination of spells and so on and so forth. But anyway, I'm just not going to continue with this.
Exit. Basically, you went through a dungeon and fought monsters and stuff. It was done entirely with past effects.
Mm-hmm.
So you had little dots for spaces you could walk on, and then you were much more
experienced. You can aid for something. So, anyway, it's already 9, so you can stay if you want and, you know, look at a couple more, but. And I believe you all know more or less what games do. You know, I just like to spend a few minutes, you know, like 15 minutes at the end of every class, just looking at some games and, you know, seeing at what.
Bring in our own Xbox system, link them together, and then have a big 16-player game on that or something?
Well, this is a class, okay? We're supposed to learn. We can't spend. And there are too many of us to play. Well, actually, maybe not. I mean, there are games that can play 16. But of course, we would need a bunch of Xboxes and a bunch of TVs because we only have one projector. It just, the logistics do not quite work out. But that's a great idea. But no, I mean, at least, you know, we can go ahead and look at games as, you know, as they are. And, you know, sometimes we'll see where games actually go wrong and where things fall apart or don't work right, which is probably where people can learn the best, you know, about graphics. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have this assignment. I have another one that, you know, works on a project that's not your game projects. But, you know, there are several that just are just doing stuff to your game projects. Yes. Honestly, you don't actually need any of the stuff that we're going to do during this quarter in order to do the next quarter. And you will need your game projects for that one. So, but anyway, you know, if anybody is fed up with their code base, with their game as they have it and wants to reset, they can go ahead and start with the one I posted in the website. That is fine with me, and it's also fine with Steve for next quarter. So, again, you know, it's kind of nice to take your own game through the courses, but yeah, at that point, it's your choice. Yeah, that's complete. That's basically his homework 8 solution. With a couple of fixes that I put in so that it's easier to deal with some of the homework assignments, and we'll talk about those. So, see you next week.
Thank you.
Yep. You bet.